Okay, good afternoon, everybody. There are three ways that you can pronounce my name. You can go with the standard American pronunciation, and that would be Wanda. I answer to that. You could try the German pronunciation, Wanda, which is just like my grandma used to call me, and I will answer to that as well. You could pronounce it in the Brazilian Portuguese way, which is my mother tongue, and then it would be Wanda. I will also answer to that. Or you can try a pronunciation of your own, and I may or may not answer to that. Before we actually start...
Doctor?
Professor, doctor, reverend, all of the acolytes, but I'm totally fine with having people address me by my first name. I've come to a stage in my life in which these things matter very little.
Good for you.
And so it's like, yeah, just first name basis, that's totally fine. I just want to let you know that the session is being recorded, and it's going to be very participatory, and I'm going to ask for your insights, for your sharing of experiences. And so if you want to do that, please do so using only your first name, because some sensitivities might arise. So just, you know, that's a suggestion, and it's standard protocol as well. Holden Village has a database of lectures that go back to the 1970s, way back when. It still was in cassettes, and then they moved on to CDs, and now it is, everything is in the cloud. But the idea is still the same, that people can go back and revisit some of these lectures. So that's the idea also for us today. Just asking you to very briefly just introduce yourselves, just by your first name, and so that I also have a sense of who am I talking to. Just say your name.
Nelius.
Native.
Barbara.
Danielle.
Mitch.
Jonette.
Rebecca.
Ray.
Julia.
Yolanda.
Renee.
Marlene.
Laura.
Sarah.
Colleen.
Dick.
Anne.
Chris.
Siri.
Kari.
Bethany.
Emily.
Catherine.
Vivek.
Eric.
Jennifer.
Ruth.
Meredith.
Behind the pole.
Bill.
And up there?
Rachel.
Emery.
Susan.
And?
Juliana.
Cassie.
And?
Elizabeth.
Okay. And you were?
Melissa.
Okay.
Late Melissa.
All right. So if you have been participating in some of the sessions today, you have heard a couple of people coughing and very quickly saying it's not COVID. I too might cough, and it's sinus. I got tested, it's negative, so just to put you at ease with that. But if you have listened to any of the other presenters today, you may have noticed that the topics being addressed are very, very dear to people's hearts, to their experiences, to their passions, to their sense of calling and vocation as well. What we are going to do today and in the following 3 days is to talk about the concept of Jubilee, but addressing particularly the things that hinder Jubilee. If Jubilee is freedom, it is life in abundance, it's a celebration of life, in everything that is plenty, in the fruitfulness of the whole creation and of humanity, if that is Jubilee, then we must realize that Jubilee is an already and not yet reality. So the topic of Jubilee is an invitation for us to grapple with the things that prevent us from flourishing of life in abundance, everything that keeps us in bondage, everything that prevents life to be lived in its fullness. So in this particular session today, we are talking about Jubilee and breaking away from the bondage of sexism. The next sessions are going to talk about other such topics. Tomorrow we will talk about racism. On Thursday we'll talk about ableism, which is something that comes from disability studies, asking us to revise some of our own concepts. And then on Friday, we will talk about classism and issues of poverty, world hunger, and so forth. So today, we start with sexism. And I choose to start with sexism because it is perhaps one of the topics that speaks closer to my experience. But you can see from the proposals that, from the topics that we will call it, all of them are very deeply interconnected. We're talking about the intersections of oppressions, we are talking about overlapping, and how experiences are not just categorized by a particular characteristic or a particular set of experiences or a particular appearance that somebody might have. So I start with sexism because it is really at the foundation of my own sense of vocation, my own calling, and the type of conversion experience that I had in my academic career. I, as I said, come originally from Brazil. I'm here with my husband, Germano, who is sitting in the back there. And during the years, we were both seminary students. Both of us had a chance to do our internship. And both of us were very committed with ecumenical experiences. So both of us, in fact, went to work with Roman Catholic bishops. And Germano went to work with in one of the parishes of Dom Helder Câmara, who was a Roman Catholic bishop in northeast Brazil, in Recife, very much identified with. And I went to work in the Amazon area with Bishop Dom Pedro Casaldáliga, who is a bishop poet, in one of the Christian-based communities. So as I was working there, our living conditions were very similar to the lives of everybody else in the village. So there was perhaps a dozen houses. The houses were covered with a straw. That was the roof. The walls were mud. There was actually no floor, just the ground that we would step on. No running water. For water, we had to go down to the river. No electricity. No inside plumbing. So we were living as the people themselves were living. And that was our commitment. I was living in a house with a priest, a nun, and a community organizer. That was our community. And one day, as I was about to leave in the next 2 weeks or so, after having finished my internship, news came to us that a woman by the name of Maria was coming to the village. She and her husband were set to the next village. They were coming from the bushes, from the inside, from the jungle area, because she needed assistance. She was pregnant, about to deliver a baby, and she was 32 years old. This was pregnancy number 8. She had 5 children, and she had had 2 miscarriages before that. So child number 8, pregnancy number 8. They did not make it to the next town because the birth pangs started, and so the only house in the village that has a bed is where they that offers the place for them to come and help them deliver the baby. News is sent to the neighboring village to have the medic, Vanja, come and help deliver the child. So because they knew it was going to be a very complicated birth, they also asked for somebody from the pastoral team, just in case things would take a turn for the worse, that there would be somebody to give the last sacraments. And that is why I was there. It was my turn. I also volunteered to go. I was there to help out. It so happened that I had a lot of knowledge, expertise, curiosity about human anatomy and reproduction, and I ended up then being the doctor's assistant as she was helping Maria deliver this baby. It was a very long, very painful, very complicated birth because Maria was undernourished. Among several of the popular beliefs was that women who are pregnant are not supposed to eat certain foods, and those foods are usually protein-rich type of foods. It was also complicated by the fact that Maria had taken birth control pills hidden from her husband. She did not want any more children. Her husband did, but she did not. But because she was suffering from malnutrition, she, as if you, those of you who are in the medical field know, birth control does not work if your body is undernourished, because everything, all the hormones are out of whack, okay? So she got pregnant. And then she came to the village and hoping to get the necessary assistance. So after several hours pushing and being encouraged, and the doctor, the medic, and I doing what we could, a miracle happened. And the miracle was, I thought at first, that this beautiful, healthy baby girl was born. And there was great jubilation. Everybody was very happy that Maria had been able to deliver this child. And so as we are cleaning and wrapping and taking care of the baby, Maria is not making a recovery. She starts bleeding. And the hemorrhage is such that from the bed, soaked with blood, it oozes off the floor, and the ground is seeped with blood. There is blood and blood and blood. And so, and Maria's collar, little by little, disappears. And there the second miracle happens, that the doctor had in her case, her backpack, a medication that could help stop the bleeding. But because Maria's arm were so thin, doctor kept poking to find a vein to insert the medication. And after several attempts, she was able to find a vein in the arm, and the medication was applied, and little by little was making effect. Maria's face started coming back, and then we thought, well, this is really the big miracle, that a woman does not die in childbirth. So as the time elapses, the doctor tells Maria, listen, you were really very, very lucky. This situation, if you ever have to put your body through so much strain, you are not going to make it. This is really the last call for you. Let's do something. And then she proceeded talking about contraception. And then that's when we found out that, you know, contraception was not an option because she had already taken the birth controls. And then the doctor said, what about tubal ligation, which is a very popular procedure in Latin America, not only in Brazil. And Maria just turns her face away from the medic and mine and stares into the wall, and she says, "You have to ask my husband. It's not up to me to decide." And so the doctor walks out, and I follow the doctor because I want to see this through, right? And so the doctor calls the husband aside, and he is celebrating with his friends outside, and and the doctor then explains in as simple a language what was at stake, that another pregnancy, Maria would die, that the procedure was very simple, that the local health clinic could help financially, that they did not have to pay for anything. And I was eagerly waiting to see what the husband would say. Can you guess what he said? He said, "I will not allow it, because what will my friends say if I don't have any more children? They will think that I'm no longer a man. And if she dies, I'll just find me another one who is younger and prettier." And that is the day I became a feminist. I was not a feminist. I was not very much concerned about issues of reproductive rights. But this really hit me. This really, really hit me. Because when we talk about having a system that allows a man to make decisions for a woman, on behalf of her, over her body, her reproduction, and gets to decide about her life and death, there's something utterly wrong with this. And I'm calling this system sexism. Some people call it patriarchy, some call it curiarchy. There are many, many names for the wrong that is at stake here. So this is the first topic that I want to address today, which is sexism as the type of the prejudice, the type of stereotyping, that the discrimination that typically has women at the receiving end, but that is not the only group that is at the receiving end of sexism. I'm talking about the experience that comes from language, practice, antagonisms, cultural norms, expectations, everything that creates hierarchies of power that somebody gets to make decisions on behalf of for somebody else, not always looking out for their best interests. And so I'm talking about hierarchies of power that perpetuate these systems in such a way that negative attitudes or negative feelings or jeopardizing somebody's future is seen as commonplace and is seen as normal. I'm also thinking about sexism as it is applicable not only to women, but also as it is applicable to the LGBTQ plus community, especially with people who do not comply what the norms and expectations of certain types of performances are. So that type of performance, can it be a man who does not act like a man, a woman who does not act like a woman? And I'm going to unpack that and invite for your own reflections of this. Oftentimes, sexism can manifest as very, very irrational fear, and it does not need to be even justified. We come from Brazil, that is one statistically wide taken into consideration, it's one of the most homophobic places in the world. The amount of people who are trans, bi, queer, homosexual, gays, or lesbians who are assassinated in Brazil is at the top of the Western world. And this is very painful for us because that is also part of our own reality. Brazil is also a place where femicides, the killing of women for the sake of honor, because a woman broke up with her boyfriend or her partner or her husband, is at the highest in the world. So these topics speak very, very close to our hearts and to our experiences. Because it might seem for people who come from contexts like, if you're here at Holden Village, we talk about sexism, and everybody is so affirmative, so respectful, and so like celebrating diversity among us. That is really, this place is really a haven in comparison, because what we see in the world at large is a lot of hostility, a lot of mistrust, and as we have seen recently, also a lot of legal restrictions, and that is only going to get worse. So I'm using some of the standard wording. Those of you who are here are probably very familiar with the nomenclature. I'm talking about differences between gender and sex, whereas sex talks about one's biology, one's anatomy, the biological characteristics that are we are born with, and most of us, and you know, exceptions granted, are given a certain set of physical characteristics and anatomical characteristics. I'm not talking about sex, I'm talking about gender, which is what culture, what society, what we have learned about our biology. And that these are the constructed rules, the norms that establish what is then acceptable for males and females. And so it's not what we are, but what we have been taught are the performances, the attitudes that that help or hinder our own development. Gender stereotypes, they are used and they are relied upon to identify binaries, male and female. And whoever extrapolates the male and female binary is usually at the receiving end of a lot of criticism for being non-conforming and so forth. I was in the southern part of Brazil, I was having tea with my sister, and she and I invited a neighbor over who had a five-year-old boy. And my sister, who is a teaching, Margit, by the way, she brought a box of toys. And the boy was very much intrigued by a doll. And so he picked up the doll and started playing with the doll. And the mother was very uncomfortable that a boy would play with a doll, because that is non-gender conforming, right? And so she was getting, you know, very restless, and then finally she shouts out and said, "Hey, boy, what are you doing with that doll?" And then, because he had his back towards us, he just turns around and said, "I'm trying to pick out its eyes." And the mom said, "Okay, carry on." My sister and my jaws dropped, and I think you needed a shovel to pick them up. Because that is the type of attitude that is brought from cradle through grave, and that justifies that a boy is not supposed to show tenderness, but if he shows aggression, if he shows destructive behavior, that is seen as boys will be boys. Okay? So I just want to invite you very quickly to share with one another what type of gender stereotypes have you encountered? And I'm talking about the type of upbringing, what has been said to you, things that you were expected to do or have done that I think helps to feed these types of gender stereotypes. What does our culture teach us about being male and female? So I'm just going to give you like 2 minutes, and so you have to be very quick. Engaging conversation. What does our culture, what has it taught you about what does it mean to be male or female? Some examples. Who wants to share? What did you hear that caught your attention?
I didn't hear that.
Who wants to share?
Oh, somebody was talking.
We're all
talking. There's too many of them. We all probably have one.
Just give us one. You don't have to cover the whole list.
I remember growing up and knowing that male gender was like lauded, right? Like this is like the pinnacle of being human was being assertive and strong. And I remember feeling confused and conflicted about how that reflected on me, who was a girl and I identified as a girl, and I didn't understand how I was supposed to do that but also be a girl. And so I just remember being confused from an early age. Mm-hmm. How do I get this thing that is like the goal but also not?
Thank you. I'm passing around a sign-up sheet if you want me to send you materials. If you have any, I also shared my email if there's any topic that you want me to send particular information, just sign up. You know, that's a good way. So men, boys being more highly regarded than girls and women. Okay, who else? A couple more. Yep.
My daughter-in-law doesn't cook, doesn't really take care of the kids. She has a fabulous job. My son does everything. And I have a problem with it because I wasn't raised that way. Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, that thinking about the gender expectations, right? Thank you. Yeah. Who else? Yep, go ahead. Anybody? Yes, thank you.
Well, I guess I could say, because I've lived long enough to see there, it's better now than it was, not where it should be. But, mm-hmm. But interesting, I'm a physical therapist. I was a member of the first class of physical therapists that was allowed to at University of Washington to have men. And I remember, two of my brothers are nurses, and I remember in my era, when I first started, that you always refer to a nurse as a nurse and a male nurse as a male nurse.
Yeah. And of course, the fact that we expect doctors, medics to be male and then nurses to be female. And
like
I think
in the movies or TV shows, the male nurse was always kind of a weird guy.
Yeah. Thank you. From the back here, thank you.
Both of my parents are pastors, and growing up in a church in New Hampshire, my dad had a congregation and my mom had her own young adults ministry separate from that. And some people liked to criticize my mom and say, you should really be here more often supporting your husband. And she's like, well, I have my own ministry though.
Yeah. I thought you had to. Okay. Go ahead, please.
I remember having it be very understood that a girl could only answer so often in class. You needed to let the boys take the lead, and you're kind of always weighing, it's like, okay, have I spoken up too many times? Have I gotten too good a score on the test? I had to learn to hide.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to cut the conversation short a little bit. So many studies have been done on this. You know, it's kind of like, where do we even start? But usually it's a very clear set in which women are brought up to present ourselves as being always very weak, physically, emotionally weak. Appearance is the number one item. You know, we need to always look our best. Over-emotional, lacking sexual desire, irrational, superficial. And if you look at institutions such as media, the education system that you were referring to, politicians, legislation, commercial groups, just take a look at the advertising industry in general, which is a multi-million, billion-dollar industry. how women are objectified. And usually it is the less clothing, the less brain. And that is a type of advertising that sells. The navigating this is very, very tricky. And girls learn this from a very early age, which I call, this is the cleavage dilemma. You know, it's like, how much is sufficiently revealing for you to be sensual, and how much is too much that makes you now slutty? And that is, and girls learn this very, very early in their lives, because it's part of the social expectation. And it is a burden. It is a burden, because it has to do with shaming whoever does not perform according to these expectations. As for men, they are usually presented as strong physically. They are not emotional, not about sharing feelings, talking. Overly sexual, rational, always focused. It's like, let's get to the point of things. And institutions such as media, education, politics, legislation, commercial groups, advertising, always capitalizes on precisely these characteristics. And that men have much more access to consuming goods, and it is about buying power, and men are supposed to be the bread earners. And I understand the dilemma, because yes, if one person then is supposed to be the breadwinner and it's not the man, it just everything is goes against the grain of what we have been brought up to do, and it is a big challenge. So if you there's a fantastic documentary by Jean Kilbourne called Killing Us Softly, in which she analyzes media and advertising, and she comes to the conclusion that capitalism is so ingrained that it makes it's able to sell products that even something that you do not want, but if it makes you look like you are performing according to these, then it's going to be appealing. So looking at the gender constructs in that as well. All of this creates, it's not just, you know, us going to a store like Target or Walmart and just looking at the pink aisle and the blue aisle when it comes to toys. These would be very interesting studies to be made, but it always creates dualities, and within these dualities, hierarchies. So I give you a list of some of the dualities. The same way you have male and female, the assumption is male is superior to female. Male has much more power, has much more privilege than female. But then you see how that applies to culture and nature, straight and queer, hetero versus homosexual, reason versus intuition, public versus private, production or reproduction, subject-object, self and other, white and black, master and slave, rich and poor, and the list goes on and on. And here is a drawing that kind of like summarizes this system, and I'm going to come back to it a little bit later in the week as well, as we think about how all of these systems interconnect. My good friend Elizabeth Schisler Fiorenza coined this word, kyriarchy. Kyrios is the Greek for Lord. And so she said, this is a system that creates masters, lords, señores, patrón, you know, people who are always the ones to make the decision and the others who are supposed to fall in place. So that's what the definition, it encompasses patriarchy, it encompasses racism, it encompasses colonialism, and it has all of these characteristics. So it's an overarching name to explain the complexity, the intersecting forms of oppression. At the center, you have the experiences, the individual experiences. It can be of age, of race, or ability, disability. It can be with body type, class background. Do you speak with an accent? Do you have a learning a disability? Do you have an age limitation? So all of these are part of the experiences. And then they are extrapolated and fit into systems of hierarchies that can be called racism and ageism and sexism and classism. And then how they take much larger format in terms of neoliberalism or patriarchy, rape culture and the immigration system, talking about the incarceration system in this country, or colonialism and so forth. So I'm going to give you a couple of arguments that have been used to maintain things the way they are. Usually I would take a whole semester to deconstruct these. So I'm assuming that if you have come to Holden Village, because you are in the know already. So I'm going to just recap a couple of these arguments. So what are some of the arguments that support sexism? The number one argument is nature. If you listen to anybody who is opposed to the LGBTQ plus community, you say, well, this is not nature. You know, this is not natural. If somebody is saying that women should have much more power or decisions, it's like, well, but this is not natural, because by nature, women are physically weak, men are physically strong, and so we bring these arguments of nature to justify why we should organize ourselves in society as such. And there have been so many philosophical treatises that use this as the core argument. The second one is religion. And one of my interests is doing comparative religions and take a look at Christianity, but then also Judaism and Hinduism and Buddhism, Islam, Afro-Brazilian religions, and so forth. And one of the characteristics of how religions maintain sexism is that whenever the argument comes up, you can always say it's God's will. This is what God has made, dictated. This is how we follow God's teachings, etc., etc., etc. And interestingly enough, whenever you have brought God into the conversation, there is no rebuttal. I mean, how are you going to argue with anybody who says, this is God's will, this is how God created us, this is what God expects from us? And then I just give you one example among the many, I mean, with encyclopedias have been written on this. The biblical theological arguments that justify misogyny, the mistreatment of women, or the plain dehumanizing effect that it would have. So this is one passage from 1 Timothy. This is supposed to be a letter that Paul writes to Timothy. The letter, in fact, we know through exegesis that it was not written by Paul, because it uses language like bishops that did not exist during Paul's time, so it was not written by Paul. it's not really a letter, it's much more like a manual of good behavior in the congregation. And it probably is from the early second century. And yeah, it's part of the canon, it's part of the Bible. And this is what it reads. Let the woman learn in silence with all submissiveness. I permit no woman to teach or to have authority over man. She is to keep silent. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet woman will be saved through bearing children if she continues in faith and love and holiness with modesty. Okay? So just turn to your neighbor and tell me, what's your reaction to this? And in addition to this, what else have you heard that is similar in tone? Okay? So give you a couple of minutes to react to this passage. Honestly, if you do that, you deprive me from great conversation. So please, 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 come talk to me. Let's chat about some of these things. I have been in quarantine and remote for such a long time. I long human contact and conversation. So, okay, just ignore that part of your welcoming instructions yesterday. So, what is your reaction to this? Yes?
Both of us said we don't take it seriously anymore.
You don't take it seriously? Okay. Anymore? Okay. Oh, all right. Thank you. Thank you. What else?
I was glad to hear that Paul didn't write it.
Okay.
Paul does get a lot of crap for being sexist.
Okay. All right. Okay. What else?
It's so contradicted by so many things in the Old Testament.
Right.
Women judges, women victors in battle, women leading the battles.
Right. It's very interesting that the arguments that you use are exactly the arguments of somebody who would have gone to a place like Luther College and is exposed to a reading of text in context and says, well, this is like way back when. I was invited to go to a Missouri Synod College of Pastors. And so that was my argument. It was like, no, you have to see that, you know, that biblical times, things have changed. But if you are Missouri Synod, and if you are, you will know it's in the Bible, and therefore it needs to be followed. And so I said, you know, sometimes with these texts, we need to use a very, not a feminist, that's my approach, but sometimes we need to read Luther against Luther, and so doing a Lutheran interpretation. So, and that's what I did. We used this text, and I said, let's take a look. What Paul, even though we know it's not Paul, but for them it is Paul, and it is in the Bible, so it carries weight. What is Paul saying here? That a woman is a second-class citizen, right? That she is not supposed to speak in church. Now, if I tell you, Ruth, be quiet, everybody is going to be like, why is she telling Ruth to be quiet? Because you only tell people to be in silence when they're actually talking. Right? Yeah? So that's what's going on, you know, that these women are talking, right? They are raising a thunderstorm over there, okay? And what are they doing? They are teaching, right? So you why would I need to tell Renee, you know, don't teach, right? It's like, because that's what she's doing, right? You are a teacher. So you realize that by reading the text, it's like you are giving us much more information than you think. Okay, so we learn that's what Paul, or well, the author that wants to pass as Paul, is encountering. And then goes into this weird justification for it, explaining that, you know, the man was created first, and then the woman, mean to say, she's like an afterthought. It's like, wait, aren't there two creation stories? One is that both are created at the same time. That's Genesis 1. God created male and female in God's image. And then the second one, which is Genesis 2, there's the creation of Adam. Adam is not a gendered being. Adam is a collective, generic human being. And only when a woman is created, you have in the Hebrew text, you have the distinction between Ish and Isha, male and female. Ish, male, Isha, female. So it's like as if Paul didn't have a lot of knowledge of Hebrew, which he was supposed to have, being a Jew. So all of these are hints that you know, there's something off with this text. But my favorite is the following. So if you are Lutheran, what is the number one thing that we learned? What is justification? You know?
Faith alone.
Yeah. Except you're a woman. Yeah. Then you will be saved through the good works of bearing children. It's like, Paul, didn't you just say in Corinthians, Galatians, Romans, that is so just looking at the text and realizing how contradictory that is. So you need to take a little bit of time exploring that. And yet it's so easy. You just say, well, it's in the Bible. This is God's will. This is what Scripture says. And you just eat chicken with feathers and all. So all of this interpretation just corroborates what scholars have said. This is rape culture, okay? And what we are living right now in this country is rape culture. Mm-hmm. A lot of toxic masculinity. And so when I talk about rape culture, I talk about how violence against women, LGBTQ+, is so normalized, trivialized, justified, oftentimes condoned. We tend to go into victim blaming. If anybody comes to a police station and says, I have been assaulted, harassed, usually the answer, the first question is this what you were wearing? Is this how you were going out? Were you out at that time? Were you intoxicated? So blaming victims and not realizing that no means no, that consent is necessary. So let me give you a couple of examples of rape culture, especially in this country. A lot of art music, rap music, pop music, emphasizing that consent, the lines of consent are very blurry. The way that human sexuality is described and enacted in movies, sitcoms, is really so far away from what human sexuality is all about. It's very consumerist, it's non-relational. And then we move into an example that brings us closer to the events of last week. For instance, a judge, this happened in Montana, a judge sentenced to only 30 years in jail a 47-year-old man who raped a 14-year-old girl who then later committed suicide and defended. The judge said that the girl was older than her chronological age. We've seen this a lot, and if you follow sports, people who come out are then vilified, they are accused. It's in terms of athletes who then are charged with rape or assault, that they are calling their victims as career destroyers. And then I would say for my generation of women, having somebody appointed to the Supreme Court, despite Christine Ford's testimony of sexual assault, if you have seen those, and I was glued to the screen and I could not believe that somebody who had that the evidence was so compelling would still be appointed. Mm-hmm. And that brings us then to overturning Roe v. Wade. And, you know, this, we had indications that this was going to happen. The Supreme Court decision, Dobbs versus the Jackson Women's Health Organization, then erased basically the rights that women had benefited from the past 50 years. And I independent of where you stand on the issue of abortion, the abortion has become, in the past, since the 1970s, an emblematic, symbolic catchphrase to that means so much more. It really brings us back to the late 1970s with a group called the New Right that was very dissatisfied with the advances from the civil rights movement, all the advances of the women's movement, and wanted to go back to the good old days. And they were able to bring together, under the banner of abortion, bring together, create this rally to go back to the good old days. And abortion is then perceived as the way to coalesce and groups that were on a variety of political spectrums. You would have very conservative Catholics who would still go back to teachings dating pre-Vatican, Second Vatican Council, very outdated. And you would get to people who were ultra-evangelical, many of them rather fundamentalist, Christian fundamentalist, who wanted to use scripture and the privileges of white supremacy, segregated schools, and so bringing together these two groups and then combating what they perceive to be as the ills of the age. So we can talk a little bit more about this, but I'm aware that our time is running out, and so I want to finish our conversation. If you want to come back and talk a little bit more about how you have interpreted the erasure of Roe, the Wade, we can do that elsewhere. But I also want to share a little bit more about Jubilee breaking bondage. And so I'm giving a couple of steps, what I think might be hopeful, might be bring us a little bit further along to the theme of the village this week. One of them is what I think is critical thinking. What we need these days more than ever, I mean, we are so bombarded by fake news, by things that have absolutely no depth or make sense and yet are just forwarded via media, is to have people critically engage the information that they get. And I think education is still the beginning of change. And that also has to do with the way that we educate our children. So thinking about deconstructing gender stereotypes, if you go back to what you were talking among yourselves and the behavior that was expected of you, like being male or female, boys and girls, it seems to me that the education, the way that we raise kids used to, I'm very hopeful with this new generation I see, you know, over here at the village. But it feels like, are you familiar with the bonsai tree, right? It feels like it is the nipping, tucking, clipping. You know, it's kind of trying to make people fit into a particular mold. And that is the type of gender education. It's like you are supposed to conform. Like boys don't cry. Women cannot be self-reliant. And you know, it really, it's like it cuts off. It just prevents us from flourishing and being the type of human beings that we want to be, that we can be. The second one is breaking bondage is by seeing connections. So what is happening even though we are talking about some of the effects of Roe v. Wade, the erasure of that as affecting women, there is such a strong effect on BIPOC population, black, indigenous, and people of color. And just the statistics are already showing the effect that that will have. We will continue this conversation tomorrow. But seeing the connections that what Primula Crenshaw so aptly described as intersectionality means they, it's the pieces intersect, they overlap. And we can start with one aspect, but it's kind of like we are untangling a web, and we realize that the more we pull the thread, we start bringing out other issues. So we start with sexism, but we talk about racism, we talk about ableism, because all of these things are connected, and Kimberly Crenshaw is the one who first came with this brilliant idea. And then, as promised, I also want to bring the Me Too as an example of hope. People are saying, well, you know, why are you talking about Tanara Burke as being, you know, as a sign of hope? Because, you know, if you have, if you look at how much dirt the Me Too uncovered, and I said, but let's just be honest, how much liberation, how much people have been able to voice the pain that they have been going through. And people like Tanara Burke, who coined this Me Too in 2006. And in highlighting the need for the support that is necessary, that we tend to think that we things only happen to us. We are the exception, when in fact it's much more prevalent. It's part of a rape culture as we have it. And if we have time for you to think, perhaps, who inspires you? What movements do you follow? Have you seen anybody who is out there or in here among yourselves? It's like, yeah, you know, this person inspires me, and this is something that gives me hope. And then I want to give you a third example, which I'm not sure you are really familiar with, but I find very helpful, which are the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America resources. There is a very compelling, very powerful statement that was adopted in 2019, titled Faith, Sexism, and Justice, A Call to Action. And here's a layout of it. Just to highlight all that this document, along with several other outstanding resources, we do not need to reinvent the wheel. If you go online, go to the ELCA webpage, and you will find resources. There are resources on sexism, on gender. There are resources on racism, on homophobia, on reproductive rights. And so take a look at what people of faith have been saying. How is it that what we have learned from deconstructing some of these misogynistic passages, you know, Paul sucks. But you know, how have people moved on and used faith communities also as a form of empowerment? And I want to just have us read three of these commitments. Can I have, actually four, can I have somebody volunteer just read out loud? Thank you.
The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America commits itself to advocate for and supports laws, policies, and practices that respect diverse bodies rather than discriminating against, objectifying, or devaluing them. Women, girls, and people who identify as non-binary must not be deprived of their human or civil rights. Advocate for and support the eradication of gender-based violence within the church and more broadly in society by addressing both the systemic aspects of such violence and the personal responsibility of those who perpetrate harm. advocate for and support medical research, healthcare delivery, and access to equitable and affordable healthcare services, including reproductive healthcare, that honor how bodies differ and eliminate discrimination due to sex, biological gender, or sexual orientation. Advocate for and support resources for families of various configurations in the communities in which they live. Empower parents and all who raise or care for children or other family members to nurture, protect, and provide for their households in ways that do not reinforce gender-based stereotypes. In particular, advocate for institutional changes that support and encourage men and boys to participate in all family roles associated with the home, caregiving, parenting, and nurturing.
Thank you so much. There are many other aspects to this particular statement. I just wanted to highlight these. That communities of faith are paying attention to, number one, that gender-based violence happens also inside the church, that everybody needs to be accountable, that the language of faith and communities of faith also have a responsibility to the world at large, including advocacy and being a presence when it comes to policy making, and in particular that I wanted to bring this aspect about healthcare and how that is part of the conversation also of communities of faith. And I want to finish with what is one of my favorite. This is a letter written by a child by the name of Charlotte, and here is a girl who is taken matters in her own hand. She is writing a letter to Lego Company, and it reads, Dear Lego Company, my name is Charlotte. I am 7 years old, and I love Legos, but I don't like that there are more Lego boy people and barely any Lego girls. Today I went to a store and saw Legos in two sections, the pink girls and the blue boys. All the girls did was sit at home, go to bed, and shop, and they had no jobs, but the boys went on adventures, worked, saved people, and had jobs, even swam with sharks. I want you to make more Lego girl people and let them go on adventures and have fun, okay? Thank you from Charlotte. Available.